Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we bring you the biography of a horse. Not just any horse, mind you, but one of the most popular race horses in history, Seabiscuit, whose popularity among its fans was not solely the result of its winning record, as impressive as it was. And after we finish with Seabiscuit, Talking History regular Alan Winkler will join us to provide some historical perspective on federal budget deficits. But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on May 13, 1975, Bob Wills, a hero of country western music, died. His musical roots were deep. Both his father and grandfather were fiddlers. Born in 1905 on a farm in Texas, James Robert Wills grew into the family tradition, playing the fiddle, mandolin, and guitar, making his first public performance at a dance in Hall County, Texas at the age of 10. He went on to play for the rest of his life, creating a unique, syncopated sound with strong beats that sounded nothing like traditional folk music. He and his band, the Texas Playboys, that grew to include 22 pieces, attracted a large national audience who liked his fusion of folk, country, cowboy jazz, and blues. And the band produced many hits like Take Me Back to Tulsa and San Antonio Rose, with sales topping 20 million records. Bob Wills was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1968.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the Neanderthal was a powerful hunter who dominated Europe for more than 100,000 years. He disappeared about 45,000 years ago when modern humans moved into their territories. The cause of Neanderthal's disappearance has never been established, but some anthropologists have suggested that there was extensive interbreeding between them and modern humans, and that Europeans are the product of that union. A new study contradicts that finding, arguing instead that Neanderthal simply died out for whatever reason, taking their genes with them. The study of mitochondrial DNA was conducted by Richard Klein of Stanford University. Klein finds that, rather than mixing, the two human forms had a common ancestor that existed in Africa about 500,000 years ago. In a new book, Stalin's Last Crime, written by Vladimir Naumov and Jonathan Brent, lends support to a long-standing theory that Joseph Stalin was poisoned in order to keep the Soviets out of war with the United States. The authors examined Stalin's doctor's records and concluded that he was fed warfarin, a tasteless and colorless blood thinner that was commonly used to kill rats. The poisoning took place, they argue, on March 1, 1953, at a dinner with four Politburo members, one of whom was his successor, Nikita Khrushchev. This is Talking History. Seabiscuit is one of the winningest racehorses in history, but he was also among the most beloved for reasons other than his success on the track. Much of that popularity, our guest this week suggests, was a reflection of the time in which he raced, the era of the Great Depression. Talking History's Eileen Dugan explores that subject with the author of a new book on the American legend, Laura Hillenbrand.
Once upon a time, before Tiger Woods, before Michael Jordan, or even Joe DiMaggio, America's biggest sports star was a horse, a smallish, crooked-legged horse named Seabiscuit. The public adored Seabiscuit and came from far and wide just to watch him race. But why? Was it just his winning record that impressed his fans? Or was there something more to his widespread appeal? With us today to explore the world of horse racing in Depression-era America is Ms. Laura Hillenbrand, author of the bestseller Seabiscuit, an American legend, and I should say, soon to be a major motion picture. Good morning, Ms. Hillenbrand.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
What inspired you to undertake the biography of a horse, and especially this horse?
I had known the story of Seabiscuit, just the horse himself, since I was a little kid. I read a story named Come on, Seabiscuit, which was a lovely book. But I didn't know anything about the people. And in 1996, I was just going through some old racing history documents, and I came across some information about the trainer and the owner and the jockey. And I realized I was looking at what I believe is the greatest underdog story I know of anyway, and I think in the history of sport. And it hit me right between the eyes. I had to do a book right away on this one.
And how do you see his career reflective of the period in which he ran?
He, in a way, one of the things I love about this story is that the union of people that handled this horse, the trainer and the owner and the jockey, reflected America at the time in a really interesting way. The trainer was a guy who'd spent 60 years out on the Mustang ranges, breaking Mustangs for the British and the Boer War, herding cattle, herding sheep. He was one of the old-style horsemen. He knew the ancient arts of horsemanship. He became completely obsolete in the 1930s because the automobile was taking over America. And one of the principal figures that brought that about was Charles Howard, the man who would own Seabiscuit. And one of the things I love about that is the balance between these two individuals. And this was going on throughout American society in the 1930s. The old world was dying off in the Depression, and a vigorous new America was springing up. This is one of the things I love about the story.
How would you describe horse racing in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s?
Horse racing was absolutely huge in America in the 1930s. It was growing very rapidly. The only sport that was doing better at the time was baseball, but by 1940, baseball was in second, and horse racing was far and away the most popular spectator sport in America. It was something that most Americans went to a racetrack on a regular basis as entertainment, and it's a different world than it is today.
But there had been a time when racing had been in decline before this.
Racing, there was an enormous temperance and reform movement around the time of World War I and a little bit before it, and racing was banned in most states of America. It survived on little backwater racetracks, and that's a big part of my book, is these individuals came up in racing during that era. And it survived at little racetracks cut through hay fields in places like Butte, Montana, and it survived its way back little tracks in Mexico. And it wasn't until the Depression when state governments needed to raise money because they were just swamped with needy people that they reorganized horse racing again and taxed it very heavily.
What about the purses? How large were they in horse racing?
They were very large. To put it in perspective, the average American in the 1930s was earning a little less than $500 a year. Seabiscuit was a bargain basement racehorse purchased for $8,000. That was a very low price for a racehorse in that era. And it's because the purses were so high and racehorses were running quite frequently. A racehorse could earn many thousands of dollars in his career, and Seabiscuit ended up earning more than any horse in history.
And what about the jockeys? Could they earn a lot of money as well?
A very few of them could, but it's only really the very, very elite, the equivalent of the Michael Jordans of horse racing could do it. Most jockeys were absolutely destitute. They were essentially owned by trainers who could stake them in poker games and trade them for horses and sell them to each other, and they paid them almost nothing. Jockeys were essentially slaves in that era, and most of them, none of them actually had insurance. And it's a very dangerous sport, and it was a very hard life for riders then.
How did they maintain their weight?
All sorts of ways. Back in that era, racehorses were assigned to carry in races as little as 85 pounds, which meant a jockey had to weigh about 2 pounds less than that in order to carry a saddle and a helmet. And they had to do all sorts of strange things to themselves to lose weight. They would, anorexia and bulimia were epidemic. They used laxatives to extremes. They devised their own laxatives. And one of the really strange things they did was they would bury themselves in track manure pits, which, because they were fermenting, were very hot, and they would sweat off weight in them.
Were Seabiscuit's jockeys also this desperate?
Seabiscuit had two jockeys, Red Pollard and George Wolfe, and they kind of represented the opposite ends of the sport. Red Pollard was, other than with Seabiscuit, not a successful jockey at all, and he was destitute his whole career. He actually, when he arrived on the scene with Seabiscuit, he had been living in a horse stall for 12 years. He couldn't afford rent. George Wolfe, on the other hand, was, in my opinion, the greatest jockey who ever lived, and he could earn very good money, and he was one of the very few who lived quite well.
How was Seabiscuit discovered?
He was, interestingly, discovered separately by his owner and trainer on the East Coast in 1936 in the summer. The trainer discovered him first. He was standing by the track rail at Suffolk Downs in Boston. The horse went by him. Seabiscuit at that time was a terribly failed racehorse. He was at the absolute bottom of the sport. He walked by the trainer, and he stopped and looked at him. And the trainer liked something about the look in the horse's eye. The horse looked regal, and the regalness didn't fit the horse, who was a very ugly little animal and very unsuccessful. And the trainer kept him in his mind. He took note of the name, although I don't know that he remembered it later, but he remembered that body and he remembered that face. About a month later, Charles Howard, the owner, was sitting in the grandstand at Saratoga Race Course about to watch a very cheap race. He and his wife looked down at an ugly little horse going to the post in a very bad claiming race. And Howard liked the look of the horse, and he pointed him out to his wife, and his wife laughed and said, "I'll bet you that horse doesn't win," and Howard took the bet, and the horse won. And Mrs. Howard purchased her husband a lemonade as to settle the bet, and they sat there thinking about that horse. And they realized they wanted him, and they sent Tom Smith, the trainer, over to the barn, and he recognized the same horse he had seen at Suffolk Downs, and the purchase was made.
What was Seabiscuit like before he was found?
He was, as I said, he was a terrible racehorse. It took him 17 starts to win his first race. He could flounder at the bottom level of the sport. Occasionally he would uncork amazing speed, but he wasn't willing to show it. He was lazy. He was sort of a conniving little horse. He would try to avoid training. And he had a lot of emotional problems. He paced in his stall. He refused to eat. He was 200 pounds underweight. And he was physically very ugly to look at, very badly put together, unsoundly put together. But he had a tremendous will to win when his head was straightened out, and that's what Tom Smith, his trainer, set out to do.
And he had a fabulous pedigree as well.
He had, well, I wouldn't call it fabulous. He had Man O' War in his pedigree. Man O' War is probably the greatest racehorse who ever lived. He was his grandfather. But Seabiscuit's parents were difficult horses. His father was such a difficult animal, such a violent animal. He was eventually just retired because he was refusing to run. And he was such a bad sire, he never produced another good horse. He ended up in the Army Remount Service. His mother was so slow that they never bothered to race her at all. So he had good blood in him, but you have to go back a generation or two to get to it.
So how did he become competitive?
He always had that competitive will in mind. Almost all thoroughbreds have it. Racehorses have been bred for hundreds of years to be competitive. They love competition. The thing with Seabiscuit was he didn't like being forced to do anything, and his first trainer was forcing him. He was having riders use the whip very heavily on him. He was racing him on an appalling schedule, sometimes running him two or three times in a week, which is today horses rarely run more than once every 2 weeks and usually less often than that. And the horse was just getting sour, and he was getting difficult. And what he needed was a trainer who could help him rediscover how much he loved to run.
You talk about Seabiscuit having a will to win, wanting to run, being difficult. Isn't that anthropomorphizing a horse?
It's absolutely possible to anthropomorphize any animal, but it is equally possible to overlook the analogies between ourselves and them. And anybody who's been around horses and been intimate in horses' lives will tell you that they are very, very much like ourselves, and you can see the same kinds of behaviors in them, especially when they're on the racetrack. They're fighting through horse races, and they are trying very hard to win, and they will do the same kinds of taunting things, some of them, that human athletes will do, that Michael Jordan will do in a basketball game. And I spoke to a lot of the people that rode the horse, a lot of the people that were around, and they all swore that this horse, he wanted to win, and he would rub other horses' faces in it. He would get up alongside them and deliberately slow down and then burst away right at the finish wire. He would let horses get a little bit ahead of them, and then he would get ahead. He would snort in their faces and do all sorts of things like that.
How did Seabiscuit come to public attention? When did he build up such a following?
I think the thing that really turned the key for Seabiscuit, he turned around very quickly once he got in the hands of Tom Smith, and he began to win and win. The thing that brought him to the public's attention was he ran in the 1937 Santa Anita Handicap, which is a race that still exists. It, at the time, was the richest horse race in the world. It had a $100,000 winning purse, which is colossal money in those days. And it was one of the first big national radio events in America, and everybody tuned in. And this horse showed up at the 1937 Santa Anita Handicap. He did not win because of a mistake by his jockey, but he ran a valiant race, and he was immediately a huge, huge star.
And how much of a draw did he finally get to be?
He was, this is hard for people to believe, but he was, by newspaper column inches, the number one newsmaker in America in 1938. Roosevelt was second and Hitler was third. This is a documented thing. Newspapers used to keep these statistics. This is a horse that had ladies' hats named after him, that had, I found thus far, 9 parlor games in his image. People would crowd out by the radio, by the railway lines, and just to get a glimpse of them through the windows of the train when he would travel across America. He was an enormous star, and at the pinnacle of his career, when he faced his great rival, War Admiral, in a match race, 40 million people were listening on the radio. That's 1 in every 3 people in this country.
How did this rivalry with War Admiral develop?
War Admiral is the polar opposite of Seabiscuit. Seabiscuit, once he was in Tom Smith's hands, was a very sweet animal. You could blow up a bomb next to him and he wouldn't turn a hair. Very social horse. War Admiral came from the East. Seabiscuit came from the West. And War Admiral was great right out of the box. He won the 1937 Triple Crown. He absolutely dominated the world of racing, but he hadn't met Seabiscuit yet, and neither one of these horses could find a horse that was good enough to really run with them. And the whole country started dividing up in this rivalry, and they didn't meet until November 1st, 1938. It took 2 years to set up this match race and finally get it to go, and it was a huge affair in America when they met.
It's been called sometimes the greatest horse race ever run. Why?
It's the greatest horse race I've ever seen. I actually just watched a film of it again last night. For one thing, a great deal was riding on it, because it's very, very rare in any sport that you get 2 all-time great athletes appearing at the same time. And this happened with these 2 horses. They were only 1 year apart in age. And it was a time when America was kind of discovering the West, when the West was coming up economically and culturally in America, and Seabiscuit began to represent the West, and people in the West became fanatically devoted with him. People in the East became fanatically devoted to War Admiral, and so a lot rode on it that way. And then when they finally met on the track, the horses delivered. This horse race, I cried when I saw this race last night, and I have seen it dozens and dozens of times, but they went head and head around the track, and they really put on a show.
And did Seabiscuit ever win the Santa Anita Handicap?
I'm not going to give that away. He spent 4 years trying to win that race, and every possible thing got in the way of it, including a catastrophic injury to his leg and 2 catastrophic injuries to his jockey. But they did come back when the horse was quite old and go for it again in 1940, and I think he unleashed his best performance there, but I won't tell you what happened.
We'll leave our listeners in suspense.
Yes.
Okay. Most authors only dream of having a New York Times bestseller, and Seabiscuit was number one for weeks on end. Why do you think this book has appealed to so many people?
You know, when I wrote this book, I wanted a chance to tell the story, but I thought because it was about a racehorse and because it was about horse racing, that it wasn't going to draw a huge audience, that people wouldn't really give it a chance. And so I was very pleasantly surprised. 5 days after it came out, it hit the bestseller list, and it did go to number one. I think the reason it did is everybody's a sucker for an underdog. And this horse and the people around him, were great underdogs, and the people around him are as much a part of the story as the horses. They were very, very compelling men, fascinating men, and people don't live lives like this very often. Each one of them had a life that was full of adventure and vigor and grace, and it makes it a very satisfying story.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, we have been talking with Ms. Laura Hillenbrand, author of Seabiscuit, an American Legend.
Thank you, Eileen. And if Eileen's interview with Laura Hillenbrand piqued your curiosity, watch for Seabiscuit, the movie, and Seabiscuit, the documentary, both coming soon to a large and small screen near you. Universal Studios will be distributing the movie, which is being directed by Oscar nominee Gary Ross, writer of Big and Dave and producer-writer-director of Pleasantville. Seabiscuit, a one-hour documentary, will premiere on PBS's American Experience series. Produced by the acclaimed documentarian Steve Ives, the documentary will include extensive rare footage and photographs, as well as interviews with many who are connected with Seabiscuit. Both the movie and the documentary rely heavily on the work of our guest this week, Laura Hillenbrand, and her book, Seabiscuit, an American Legend. Finally, we conclude this week's program with another guest commentary provided by a Talking History regular, Alan Winkler. Winkler, distinguished professor of history at the University of Miami, gives us some historical perspective on federal budget deficits and past administrations' attempts to deal with them.
Once again, the budget deficit is soaring out of control. After years of red ink, the United States managed to bring the deficit down and to eliminate it entirely toward the end of Bill Clinton's presidency. But now a combination of skyrocketing medical costs and disastrous tax cuts has pushed us into a deeper hole. Deficits are not always bad. Indeed, the great English economist, John Maynard Keynes, argued in the 1930s in the General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money that deficits could pump money into the economy in time of depression to break a cycle that was causing a kind of permanent equilibrium at a very low level. Deliberate, sustained, counter-cyclical spending was necessary, even if it caused a deficit, and the deficit could be repaid once economic recovery occurred. This Keynesian analysis explains why the Great Depression took so long to overcome. There was spending for welfare and public assistance in a humanitarian effort to avoid starvation, but some New Deal initiatives undermined others, and the aggregate spending levels were not as high as they could or should have been. The quadrupling of defense spending in 1940 and the continued massive spending during World War II jump-started a return to prosperity and vindicated the analysis of Keynes. Some future leaders, notably Dwight D. Eisenhower, resisted deficit spending. For Ike, a national budget was like a household budget and needed to be kept balanced. Unfortunately, by trying to trim the budget whenever a downturn threatened, Ike helped provoke three recessions in 1953-54, 1957-58, and 1960-61. The tax cut that John F. Kennedy proposed and Lyndon B. Johnson implemented worked as planned, and stimulated economic growth. But spending for the Vietnam War while still spending for reform at home sabotaged the economy for years to come. Even so, deficits remained under control until Ronald Reagan assumed the presidency in 1981. Then the decision to slash taxes for the wealthy while increasing defense spending by $1.5 trillion over a five-year period wrought economic havoc. The annual deficit was $74 billion in 1980, $283 billion in 1983, and $290 billion in 1992. Now the forecast is for the deficit to go even higher. 2 years ago, the Bush administration said there would be a surplus of $262 billion in 2004. Last year, it projected a $14 billion deficit for that same year. Now it tells us that the deficit is going to be $307 billion for 2004. It's likely to grow even higher in the years ahead, and this does not even include the cost of a war with Iraq. One culprit, of course, is the tax cut implemented a year ago. Another culprit is the unconscionable $674 million tax cut just proposed to take effect over the next 10 years to the advantage of the most prosperous Americans. The situation is desperate. The deterioration in the long-run budget outlook is nothing short of catastrophic, according to economist Paul Krugman. At this point, a fiscal train wreck appears inevitable once the baby boomers retire in large numbers. Alan Greenspan, longtime chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, called for fiscal responsibility in the 1990s. He urged both Congress and the President to eliminate deficits and pay off the national debt. With the assent of the Bush administration in the past 2 years, he changed his tune and supported the first tax cut. Only recently has he suggested that the proposed tax cut would be a mistake. We're now faced with the steepest deficit shift, almost $570 billion in American history.
You've been listening to Alan Winkler, Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University of Ohio. And with that, we end another weekly offering of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer, Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. You can learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Oh, Tommy. Pig. Oh, come on now, Brother Pig. Let's play it out. Yeah.